Welcome to another episode of Getting Off the Hamster Wheel, how to find a career that brings you joy, fulfillment, and success. My name is Karen Weeks, and today we have Mitch Young joining us. Mitch has a career where each time something didn't go as planned, he was introduced to an amazing new opportunity that has brought him so much joy. So let's jump in and hear Mitch's story. Hi, everybody. I'm so excited to have Mitch on the podcast with us today. Mitch, welcome, and we'd love to have you say hi to everyone and give a quick introduction.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Karen. It's exciting and honored to be here. So yeah, I have been in the tech sales leadership world for about 6.5, almost 7 years now between Pittsburgh and New York City, and in a very non-traditional sense, as we'll no doubt get into in the next 30 so minutes. Have been a pastor at one point, have been a full-time salesperson at others, leader at others in sales organizations, and then also a coffee roaster and building out a consumer goods business. So it has been a ping pong ball of a career path, to say the least, but I'm excited to be here.
Well, thank you. And I always believe hearing people's stories really helps others recognize they're not in this alone. Other people have had different kinds of journeys, and it's all about finding what makes sense for you at that moment and not worrying about, you know, how you got there or when you got there. So let's kind of rewind a little bit and start at the beginning. So, you know, folks kind of 18, 19, 20 either go to school or go right into the workforce. They think they know what they want to be because we know everything at that age. How did you start your sort of adult career?
Oh, man, you're bringing back some smiles and laughs and anxiety. Because it's true. I mean, I look back when I was in my teens going into college thinking that, you know, ultimately what I cared most about at that season in life was swimming. Which is funny because, I mean, I was what I would call a self-proclaimed realist, so I should have understood that I wouldn't be a Michael Phelps. But in your mind, at an 18-year-old swimmer, you think, okay, well, hey, I got to find the best swimming school. And thankfully, I had some good mentors back then that said I also needed to have good academics because there was a chance that I wouldn't be an Olympian swimmer, which actually panned out. Shocking, I know. And so they said, well, go find a good school with good academics, because I've had the privilege of getting to swim on kind of a tertiary team for the U.S. team in high school. So I was exposed to that, you know, freshman, sophomore year college, qualified for Olympic trials. And so I knew that there was definitely something there, but I wasn't going to make an income from swimming as my thing. But I wasn't thinking that clearly. And so thankfully I chose a smaller school. It was actually a private college, Grove City College in Pennsylvania of all places, because it was one of four Division III schools that had good academics, like nationally acclaimed academics and a competitive team. So I didn't have a whole lot of a choice. So I chose Grove City because I liked the campus, to be honest. And then I chose English literature as my major because I loved literature and philosophy and thinking about why humans process reality the way that we do. And I also thought that, hey, I could read and swim and I'll be fine and play Frisbee. That's about as far as my thought process was. I wasn't like my friends who, you know, I'm going to be an engineer and change X, Y, and Z over the next 10 years, or I'm going to be a doctor because this is my passion. I had no idea what I wanted to do at all.
Well, I think that's fair. Again, I mean, you don't realize it in the moment because you're only 18, 19, 20, whatever people are, but of course you don't know what you're going to be. You have only been exposed to certain things. So you knew swimming, you knew reading, you enjoyed, you know, hanging outside. So campus was important. Those were the only things you had been exposed to. So of course that's what you thought was important.
Oh, 100%. And it's funny because then once you're in it, you know, I always look back on it. My sophomore year of college, I actually ended up having a really bad cycling accident that ended my swimming career entirely. So I had to have metal plates installed in my shoulder. I couldn't lift my arm higher than this. And my now wife says that that was the single best thing that ever happened to me for many reasons. One, it was only after I left swimming behind that I started to think seriously about, oh crap, what do I do now? And it's once I started to think, oh crap, what do I do now, that she actually was finally willing to date me. And now we've been married for 11 years. Because before that, she didn't take me seriously either. You know, it was, who is this guy? He doesn't care about his future. He just wants to swim and he's not Michael Phelps. So what's he doing? But then it was in that moment, it was like, okay, well, what do I do? I still like English. But I realized even in 2 years of college, another oh crap moment, which was, I love reading, but I hate talking about books and I'm planning on being an English professor. this is bad. That doesn't necessarily set me up for success. And so I kind of did an introspective analysis. I said, well, why do I want to teach? And ultimately, because I like to help people and I want them to see things differently. And so then I did a deeper thought. I was like, well, why do I like helping people? You know, my dad was a doctor growing up. I was always fascinated by science. I was like, well, maybe that's what I'm supposed to do, be a doctor. So of course I did a quick analysis, realized that if I quickly transferred schools for 1 year, I could still graduate on time, but graduate with English Lit and biology and go to med school. And so I transferred colleges my senior year of all the years another school in Pennsylvania called Messiah College, and picked up my second major. And it was there that things started to get kind of interesting, Karen, because they had their inaugural season for their swim team that year. They had never had a swimming program. And their head coach at the time, Nancy Lulley, saw my name on the transcript list, did a quick Google search, saw my name as a three-time All-American swimmer. And she said, I have to get this guy to come swim. And so she immediately called me off the transcript list.
Oh my gosh.
And I said, Nancy, I hate to tell you, but the whole reason I'm coming is because I can't swim any longer. I had an injury. And she said, well, can you help coach? It's like, sure, I can help coach. And it paid for some of my college, which is cool.
Yeah,
like through credits and stuff. And but then it was in the time span of that I was asked to kind of lead the team pep talks, if you will. So, you know, before meets, getting the team pumped up and excited about what we were trying to accomplish collectively and the vision and mission of what a team is, and, you know, suffering in swimming and how that makes us better as people. And I took it for granted. I enjoyed it. It was a blast and I loved it, but I didn't think twice. And it was when I graduated from there that I never forget. I got I call it a carefrontation, from the coach and from the two team captains, right as it was the last day of classes, I was going to move back to Pittsburgh. And I was going to go to Hershey Med to go to medical school. And they called me into Coach Lulley's office and they said, hey, we wanted to talk to you about something because we think you're pursuing the wrong career path.
Oh my gosh.
And I said, you got to be kidding me. This is going to be hilarious. What do you think I'm supposed to do? And they looked me in the eyes and said, hey, we think you should consider being in full-time ministry or being a pastor.
Wow.
Because these team talks that we've had, these pep talks, have been like life-changing. And they've really helped us like think about ourselves better and about these things differently. And the way you can put these things like universal suffering in terms that make us want to participate in that versus shy away from it is unique. And I just laughed. I was like, there's no income in that. I'm not doing it. And so I said, thank you. I walked out of the office. I thought it was really sweet. And I called my fiance at the time. And I said, you're never going to guess what happened. And I told her what had happened. And the response was dead silence for about 10 seconds. And then she said, hey, I actually have wanted to talk to you about the same thing.
No.
And I was like, all right, this is ridiculous. So,
oh my gosh.
Fast forward, what I did, I decided not to like forget med school, but I deferred. I said, I'm not going to go yet. Let's just take a job at a Starbucks. Let's get married and let's do an internship at a local church here in Pittsburgh and just see if I like it, see if it's something that I want to pursue. And that very quickly evolved into almost a 3.5 to 4 year period of my life right out of college of being in full-time ministry, working with middle school, high school, and college students. And so, it just talk about not choosing the path and it just kind of happening. I felt like I was more along the ride than I was guiding the ship. So,
lot
of learnings, that's for sure.
And not to pry, and if you don't want to, you know, share too much, I completely understand. Were you religious before this, or was it more about connecting with people and motivating them and supporting them and sort of that side of it?
That's a great question. I think, so I have a very religious upbringing, but it was religious in the sense of like very strict, doctrinal, judgmental, judge and jury type stuff. And so I love my parents to death. They're amazing people, but they have a very different stance on what they believe, let's call it Christianity or religion, is meant to be. And at the end of the day, I have a very strict belief that I am not supposed to be the judge nor jury. My job on earth is to selflessly and sacrificially love every human being that I come in contact with, independent of who they are, where they come from, or what they believe, period. And that's just something that I oftentimes butted heads with the church on. And not to label the whole church as that, but just certain subsects were. And so as a kid, that's what I grew up in. So it was like, yes, I have a religious foundation, but it's not something I ever considered pursuing because to me, people in full-time ministry were, judgmental, rule beaters, and that's not me. And it's like, how can I be a pastor when I enjoy a great cigar and a good glass of scotch? I don't know how that's going to work out. But ultimately, I found out in my time in ministry that actually, honestly, is the perception of the church is largely skewed because of the vocal minority, and that there's a big group of people out there just trying to make the world a better place.
Yeah.
And so that part of it, I really enjoyed.
That's amazing. Well, and I think that is something that a lot of people miss, but is very natural, no matter the group that you're referring to. You either base it on your experience with that group, or like you said, the most vocal, who are often the minority. And that's unfortunately the brand a group gets, no matter what the group is. Exactly. And so for you to have the experience of seeing a different side of it and then sharing that through the work you did, and I'm sure through conversations since and now with a podcast audience, is very special. And I think it's so funny your wife or your future wife saw that in you as well. So obviously there was something there.
Yeah. And I think it was interesting because on the surface level, it's like, okay, hey, maybe you enjoy the shepherding side of stuff, the relationships. But over time, to be perfectly honest, in that 3.5 year tenure, I realized that it was more the vision casting and getting people excited to become better versions of themselves that I enjoyed the most. And it was then being able to see what I call true entrepreneurship. So making the world as it ought to be and helping people want to do the same. And so it's not about, hey, how do I come into this with this consumeristic mentality? How can I be better? It's no, how do I become better so that I can serve and sacrifice for those around me so that they experience that, period. Like nothing in return. And that to me is a principle that hopefully I can carry on with me to every stage of business as well. And that's what I think true leadership is it's what I call agape love. It's not a feeling, it's not an emotion, it's a choice that I wake up every single day and dedicate myself to sacrificing my needs for the benefit of those around me. And I didn't realize how much that really did transfer into business until eventually my time in full-time ministry came to a close.
Yeah. And it's so interesting how something that is very special to us and unique to us and something that we do just naturally can flow through everything that we do. And I've known some amazing salespeople, and motivation and focusing on what the other person needs is what either A, gets them the sale, or B, helps them motivate the team that they then lead. So did you consciously move in that direction? Or was it like, okay, I know I don't want to do this anymore. Now what?
Oh man. So the theme is oh crap moments. I don't know if you picked up on that yet, but the next oh crap moment was when we had left working for the large church in Pittsburgh. We kind of moved across the country to Colorado actually to start a collaborative ministry that got churches, despite their denominational differences, to work together for the purpose of community transformation. So don't think about building bigger church buildings, but how do we free up that capital to infuse back into our communities by sponsoring wrestling teams who can't afford to go to state, or buying dilapidated real estate to help the town and donate those to underprivileged citizens, whatever it might be. That was kind of my passion for that next season. And I loved it. We were pumped. We were so excited. We moved out there, and 7 months into that initiative, of which we were raising our own support, I found out that my wife was pregnant while we were living in my parents' upstairs with no income. So it was an oh crap moment. I think I used a 4-letter word that time, actually. Once again, I don't think I was cut out to be a pastor, but in that moment, it was this can't continue. I need to find something to do. We need to be able to pay bills for this unborn child that's going to be with us in 9 months. And so I called some mentors from back here in Pittsburgh, and I just said, I don't know what to do. And all of them said, well, hey, why don't you come back here? We have a big network and we can try to find you a job. And in my naive mind, I was like, I just need to find a job in business. Like that's this holistic like mushroom umbrella concept of the business world, because that's where the money is. But I hadn't thought through at that time that I didn't have a resume that set me up for a career in business. And it was kind of this crazy dream to come back and do it. But we had a family who paid for us to move back to Pittsburgh. We moved in with another family once we got back here. We got here on June 1st of 2013, it was. Our baby was born on August 4th of 2013. And between June and August, one of my roommates from college actually called me up. I was job searching. I literally, like every single morning, I didn't own a suit. So a buddy of mine who was 5'6" and I'm 6'4", he gave me a suit where the coat fit, but the pants didn't. So I had to buy socks that matched the color of the pants. And I would just meet at Caribou Coffee on Carson Street in Pittsburgh every single morning. I'd get my phone out. I'd dial all of the people I knew in the business world. And I just said the same thing. I was like, hey guys, this is Mitch. I'm back in Pittsburgh. My wife is newly pregnant. I'm trying to find a job. Are you guys hiring?
Wow.
It was that simple.
Yeah.
And of course, a ton of people like, oh man, Mitch, I'm glad you're back. We're not hiring right now, but it's a rejection. But eventually met with a couple, met up with a guy named Sean Amirati, who is with Birchmere Capital here in Pittsburgh. He was tied to a tiny seed stage company at the time called No Wait, that just so happened to be a company that my roommate from college had helped start. And so all of those strings kind of aligned, and I'll never forget Evan Adams, who is now my business partner with Rich Barn, was one of the founders of No Wait. And I called him up. He was also my little in our fraternity. and so all of those connections are fantastic, but I called him up and I said, hey, Sean said, you guys are hiring. Are you willing to meet? And I could just sense it in his voice. He was so excited to like string this one out. But he said, sure. You know, what are you, did you just get done with interviews? Are you still wearing your suit? I said, yeah, I am. And he says, okay, perfect. Come on over. Here's my apartment. I'll meet you there and we can talk through this job opportunity. And I show up in my suit. He didn't tell me that there was no air conditioning, but he knew there was no air conditioning. He knows I hate heat. And it was 99 degrees. And I'm sitting in his upstairs just dripping in sweat. And he's playing like this hardball game, like Glengarry Glen Ross type stuff. And it's just like, you know, and it was just complete farcical. It wasn't real. And then at the end of it, he's like, yeah, this would be awesome. We'd love to have you come on board and do this. Let's think through it. And so we thought through it. They were able to pay me something, which was better than nothing. And so I took the job as one of their first salespeople ever at the company. There were, 13 of us at the company at the time. And that decision changed my life.
Yeah. And you really were just looking for anything. So the fact that you ended up at a startup and that has then, you know, gone through your career since was just total coincidence.
Yeah, exactly. And it's crazy too, because I mean, I'll be honest, and this is great advice for those who are in that first time job searching market. Yeah, on paper, that job was not sexy. You know, it was like, I'm selling iPad software to restaurants. And here I am coming from this big vision backed job of like, man, we're selling life change. We're going to change the world. And now I'm just selling out to the man and selling restaurant tech software where people can text someone instead of getting a buzzer. And at first I was like, this sucks. But then I realized, wait a second, this doesn't suck. Like, this is a chance for me to A, provide for my family, and B, learn something. And very quickly after arriving at No Wait, I realized that I loved it. And it wasn't just the sales side of it that I loved. It was the science behind it and the funnel conversions and understanding A/B testing and how to build and scale the organization. It was just like this massive chess puzzle that you'd constantly be playing with yourself. And it was addicting. It didn't feel like a job. And cold calls, 100 a day, didn't seem so insane when I knew the contribution that it was making to the future of the business, because it was that work that we can build upon for future teams to come. And I've been pretty much in some way, shape, or form ever since that decision, which largely was, like you said, almost happenstance. We just had to get a job.
Yeah.
I have now been doing that in some shape or form ever since.
And what's so amazing about sometimes, you know, people can call it whatever they want. I do believe people get put on the path they're meant to be on, even if there's weird journeys and detours. And I'm not saying fate has a plan for all of us or, you know, anything. That's not what you believe. But there is something about you made that phone call. It happened to be roommate with the little brother from the sorority. I mean, there's just so, or from the fraternity, there's just so much that just happened to work out. That there's something out there that sometimes says, maybe this was where I was supposed to be, but that was the journey I had to take in order to get there.
Oh, 100%. I mean, I think I was too prideful before that to have ever chosen a position as a salesperson. Because to me, a salesperson was the dude on the street corner with the suit coat selling watches, or the guy who ripped me off with my first used car in high school. That's what I thought sales was. And so I thought I was above that. And it sounds horrible, but that's pride. And that's where my heart was at the time. And so I wouldn't have been willing to consider it. And so it was only by losing what I thought was my dream. So I had to literally lost that overnight. And I had to trade it in for something that didn't feel like my dream to actually realize, hey, this is what I think I was made to do.
Well, I think sometimes too, when you're actually in it, you start to recognize you're not, you know, working for the man. You are helping other small businesses who are restaurants able to probably get more customers because they're not like, you know, oh, I don't want to deal with the buzzer. Or you're making the customer's life easier because they already have the stupid phone in their hand. So that's the way they connect versus dealing with a buzzer that might be annoying. Or, you know, you can find, not trying to make falsehoods, but you can find the ways you're actually helping other people's lives, even if it's selling restaurant iPad tech.
Oh yeah. I mean, I think the light bulb moment for me, and once again, it's not selling something that's false. It was the real thing. It is when we first had our child and we realized that when we wanted to go on a date night and we had to get a babysitter, we only had a 2-hour window. And I'll never forget that we would only choose restaurants that had no wait because we knew that we could get in line before we left the house because we had no money. Like it was a tiny salary. We're talking like $25,000 base salary with barely any commissions. It was like well below the poverty line. It's a tiny startup. And I realized all of a sudden, like, wait a second, because of the system that I am personally selling, I can go on a date night and invest into the relationship that is most important to me. And if I didn't, all of these other places would have too long of a wait. We wouldn't be able to afford a babysitter for the additional hour, and we wouldn't be able to go out for a date. It's like, that's the experience that we get to create. And that's what motivated me. It's like, if I can create more of those experiences and get more people to sit down face to face with a great glass of wine and a good meal, that is redemptive work to me. Yeah. And that's what No Wait was all about. And I think ultimately that's something that I try to coach a lot of salespeople on now is sometimes what the company says is a vision and mission or what it looks like on paper sometimes might not motivate you personally. And so let's actually sit down and think through what about my product and service does resonate with me and how can I wake up each day reminding myself of that. And then that is my fuel for the day, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's a great segue because, you know, once someone gets into sales, there's so many places you could take it. You could just be a kick-ass sales rep for the rest of your life, make tons of money and like stay there. You could go into management and leadership. You can go into sales training and sales ops. So how did you sort of continue to find your way through your sales career once you knew that was a good place for you?
Yeah, I mean, it definitely thematically appropriate. We're more oh crap moments. I mean, you'd think you'd get to a place where you feel highly strategic and in control of it, but that really hasn't happened yet. So maybe that's a fable. But for me, it was, you know, we built this thing. We built it way faster than we thought we would. And eventually we were acquired by Yelp for $40 million in 2016. Wow. You know, I was one of the four key employees during that acquisition, which is still nuts to me. Like either they're stupid and don't realize that I wasn't that important or something happened. But ultimately, when that happened, it put me on a different visibility level across the country in terms of, okay, hey, recruiters and people reaching out like, hey, this was, you know, the vice president of local and mid-market sales at No Wait, it was just bought by. So now they want to bring me in. And so I think what I did in that next season is I love Yelp. I'm very grateful to them. It was a large company, and I think I realized that my sweet spot is slightly smaller. So I decided to part ways with Yelp. But once again, I had never truly actually job searched with a resume because I never made a resume. And so, of course, what I did is I called up one of my longtime mentors, Jim Duddy, who was in the early days of LinkedIn and had worked with me as an interim VP sales at No Wait. And I just said, Jim, I don't know what to do. You know, No Wait's done. I need to find a new job. I've never really job searched with a resume. And he said, well, why don't you just come work with me? I was like, wait. I didn't even know you were working. He said, yeah, I just took a job at this amazing recruiting marketplace company. And I need a right-hand man and I trust you and I'd love to have you. And I surface level vetted the opportunity, which I will never do again. And Jim and I we both know that. But I was like, you know what, this is great. It was in Manhattan, so I had to move. So I had to, seemed like a cool adventure. And I was like, we only have, you know, two kids at the time. It's like, they're both little, worst case scenario, they hate it and they won't remember it. They're little. And we said, let's just do it. So we did and moved up to Connecticut. I was running North American sales for the East region for that company for about 9 months and made a lot of mistakes there, honestly. You know, it was my first time being a person who inherited a team. And I was naive and I wanted to come in and, you know, make waves and live up to the expectations of my senior leadership. And I didn't take the time to slow down, to earn trust, to sell the product myself, and instead came in guns blazing. And I never really gained the true trust capital of that team. Mm-hmm. And it's something that, honestly, when that happened and when I came home one day, 9 months into it, and my wife was curled up in the fetal position on our couch saying that she couldn't do this anymore.
Oh.
Because I was gone from 5 a.m. until 10 p.m. every day because we chose to live in Connecticut. And people in New York well know the Metro North. And, you know, it was a lot. And so all of that kind of coalesced to happen two things. One, I knew I couldn't continue on with Hired. And I couldn't stay in New York. We needed to probably get back to Pittsburgh.
Mm-hmm.
And B, it actually kind of made me second guess my own abilities as a leader. Hmm. You know, I think I take servant leadership so seriously and I executed that so poorly in that position, that I started to doubt my own abilities to be in, you know, senior level leadership at a company. And it was a big identity crisis for me, candidly. And so when we came back to Pittsburgh, it was more of, okay, hey, well, what's next? Let's take a shorter term contract with a company. We did that here in Pittsburgh, a cybersecurity company who had just been purchased by a larger firm, and helped them through that transition. And it was then that I met serial entrepreneur Jason Wolf here in Pittsburgh, who I had invited to come speak at a nonprofit that I had helped start here. Our nonprofit basically partners with, you know, people in their 20s to 30s who are in their first career stage, and helping them de-romanticize the success ideal. People in who are highly successful people, you know, CEOs of Fortune 500s, and basically the whole talk isn't about how they succeeded, it's about how they failed and screwed everything up.
Oh, that's
and
great.
You see all these eyes, you're like, oh, whoa, okay, this isn't some unattainable thing. I just need to love people around me and I need to use the gifts and skill sets that I have and think others first. And usually things work out decently well, at least. And I asked Jason to come speak via LinkedIn with a cold outreach. He said, let's meet at Starbucks. And we met at Starbucks for what was supposed to be a 15-minute call or a conversation. Turned into a 3-hour diagramming session on the mud of his Suburban in the parking lot. Literally drawing funnel metrics in there because he opened up to me about this brand new idea he had in the gifting space. And within a week, he asked me to come lead revenue for them. And at that time, A, it felt good to be believed in again.
Mm-hmm.
But then also it was just me and him and the founders. And it was, you know, plenty of backing because he was a successful entrepreneur mm-hmm. prior to this. And it just made sense. I was like, okay, I'm not inheriting a team. I trust Jason. Let's get in here and do this thing. And that was also one of the best, experiences that I've had in a long time.
Wow.
And it reinstilled my belief in myself. It reinstilled my belief in a redemptive entrepreneur, in entrepreneurism
mm-hmm.
and, was loving that all the way up until the next oh crap moment, which was COVID.
Yeah. Yep.
You know, and that throws a whole nother wrench in things.
Yes. Well, and I think that it is so important to recognize when you have stumbled and mm-hmm. have the humility to say, well, that didn't go well. And this was my part in that not going well. And mm-hmm. recognizing when it's time to step away from that. And, you know, I'm sure there was a stubbornness of like, no, we've moved to New York. We're going to make this work, et cetera, et cetera. But you know, if people aren't happy and it's not the right fit, having the confidence, humility, self-awareness, push, whatever the thing is, to say, no, let's not keep going down this path before this gets worse. Let's just say this was not the right step and we'll re-step somewhere else. It takes a lot to be able to say that out loud to yourself, your family, your boss, everybody.
It was hard. It was really hard. And thankfully my wife has never lost belief in me through this whole process, which means she's actually probably not as bright as I thought she was. But at the end of the day, it's like, look, when you surround yourself with people who are building into you and pouring into you, especially after a season like that, it's amazing how quickly you can get back up.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that whole season kind of helped me realize that after No Wait, I mean, when I first took the job at No Wait, it's just because I was desperate. I needed something. And I was so grateful for that opportunity that I was motivated almost solely by gratitude. I wanted mm-hmm. you know, wear our CEO to believe that, hey, Mitch takes this seriously. And I wanted him to know that, hey, I take this seriously. You took a risk on me with no background. So I'm going to work the tail off. And it wasn't about me. It was about them.
Yeah.
But as soon as the pride starts to sink in and we sell the company and I start to think I'm the shiz, and I go up to this new company as this hothead, just thinking, hey, I can come in and just use my playbook and crush it. You know, that is not humble. That is cocky. That's prideful. And there's never a scenario that I have been in since then that I realized that my playbook is the playbook. Mm-hmm. It is merely, it's a knowledge foundation that I have that can help me understand things, but every playbook's going to be different. And the only way I can learn that is by learning what has been by the existing mm-hmm. people, which means I have to elevate those who are there before me to a place above me. And I didn't do that there. And so I didn't do that with them. I didn't do that with my wife. That season is filled. I don't call them mistakes. I'm very thankful they happened because had they not happened, I don't think I would have had my ego beat out of me. Yeah. But once you get the ego beat out of you a couple times and you wipe more babies' butts, there are many and get thrown up on all the time eventually. And then you buzz your head and you look like a peach because my red hair glows like the fiery sun. Eventually it's like, who am I trying to win? And what am I trying to prove? I just need to wake up each day and get back to my pastor roots, which is just serve the people around me, love them selflessly, and try to accomplish bigger things collaboratively and collectively. And that kind of is what reignited at the times we gift you.
Yeah. Well, and I think that's what is so special about the way you've approached your journey is that you have had those moments, those oh crap moments where yes. life threw you a curveball. You lost yourself maybe a little bit. You were down one path and something else happened. COVID happens, which is out of all of our controls. But if you kind of keep looking back in and saying, this is what's important to me. This is actually why I do what I do. This is what I'm trying to be purposeful about. I will figure this out, because if you keep going back to that, that helps center you to find whatever the next opportunity may be.
Oh yeah, big time. And I think that's ultimately, I would call it, it was an oh crap moment, but followed very quickly by a, okay, we can do this moment, which was COVID. And I mean, mm-hmm. ultimately it was the right decision. That's the next stage of my career where COVID comes. You know, rightfully so, our exec team and a big portion of Giftia was laid off immediately. Because our primary clientele was restaurants and retail. And fast forward to now, and I'm consulting for them and we're building it up. And we just signed some of the nation's largest brands again. So it's happening again, which is huge. But in the midst of not being full-time employed, I was faced with the realization. And that realization was, in the midst of a pandemic, in the midst of dire circumstances, there are three little kids and a beautiful woman who are looking to me to set the tone for how I will allow myself to interpret those and either be rattled by them or be inspired and motivated by them. And Evan, fast forward all the way from back in the 08 days, calls me up and he says, hey, I got your text last night. You're done with Giftia. What are you thinking? I said, I don't know. I don't know what to do. I don't know what's next. The job market clearly isn't great right now. It's not a good time to be finding a job. And he said, well, man, you have great connections with a lot of small companies that you're helping all the time. Why don't we do something? Why don't you go and consult and just help these seed stage companies and Series A businesses get their go-to-market playbooks and set up their CRM instances for the first time, the stuff that you love to do, and kind of boost the morales of some of these CEOs and COOs who have been trying to sell, but it's tough because they're too close to it. It's like, and on the side, you've always loved coffee. And I've been roasting coffee for myself and close friends for about a year at that point. And he was like, what if we tried to use this as an opportunity to help other people? And he said, what if we started a coffee company? I was like, Evan, you're crazy, man. Like, this is starting a company in a pandemic is a horrible idea. And he said, no, but seriously, bear with me. What if we did contactless to your home coffee delivery services at a price point that is very affordable? And we do it with a donation model similar to our buddies up at Bombas. And it's like, for every bag that we sell, we'll donate a bag to somebody who has been impacted by COVID-19, just like yourself. And I was like, well, how is coffee going to help someone who lost their job? And he's like, well, look at you. Like, you're sitting there at your desk in your basement sipping coffee because you need energy to go find a job. He was like, it's more the thought that counts. It has nothing to do with the coffee itself. And that very quickly turned into something that materialized into a much bigger vision and mission. We're partnering with a local homeless shelter here called Light of Life, which is the largest shelter in Pittsburgh. We found out that they were spending between $40,000 to $70,000 a year on coffee, which is a lot. I mean, that's like two full-time jobs for a shelter. And we said, well, wait a second, what if we take the donation model, we flip this, we partner with shelters, We then go get monthly subscribers at $14 a month. And we can literally, if we get X number of subscribers, we can give all of Light of Life's coffee to them for free every single month, freeing up all of the money that they were spending on that. And Light of Life loved it. We have influencers that are excited about this.
Gosh.
We're just in the midst of launching that. And at the end of the day, our vision and mission now with that, which is a side business, is in the next 3 years, which is how we're, our trajectory right now, is to be able to free up all of the capital being spent on coffee at 25 homeless shelters across the United States, equating to almost $10 million when you add it all up and all the stuff, by going out and getting subscriptions. It feels good because people are already buying coffee. So yeah, we might as well deliver it to your house at a cheaper price point. And then you're helping a bigger cause. And then we actually will be partnering with those same shelters to hire someone from the shelter. So someone who is underprivileged, to train them on how to roast coffee, which is a very desirable trade nowadays. Mm-hmm. So that we can create jobs and a mentorship program to start creating full-time placements in local markets for local coffee roasteries. And it's like, none of this stuff would have happened. And the consulting has been so fulfilling, mm-hmm, because I get to help all tons of companies at once. But guess what? None of it would have happened had there not been another oh crap moment.
Yeah.
And instead of using that moment to think, oh, woe is me, it was, okay, hey, in this moment, think external. And finally, after, 10 years of career, I hopefully have started to learn, don't think about Mitch, think about others, and use that to motivate you. And it has been probably the most fulfilling 4 to 5 months of my life.
Oh my gosh. That is such a amazing and not end, but bookend to the story so far. Because I don't want to say it's the end, because I mean, obviously there's lots in front of you, but what a inspiring way to look at things. And I think that, the other thing is, you were describing the coffee piece, is that people also just want to feel normal in times that are tough. And just to be able to have a cup of coffee, like, that was something I didn't have to decide if I could afford today, or that was something I didn't have to feel different about today. I got it because I always have it. And that can go a long way when people are having struggles or, impacted by what's going on. So the fact that, I can go to a shelter and that part feels normal to me is so important.
Yeah. And I think for those of us stuck at home, clearly now more than ever, I think we want to be doing something to help and to help others who have been severely impacted by this, but we don't know where to start. And I learned this, my buddy Alex Cohen up at Bombas, I learned this from him, that ultimately, if there's a consumer decision that's already being made, but we can then take that and create a redemptive process around it where it can then supply the same thing for others, that's a great way to cut through the stigma that to be a philanthropist, you have to have $100,000 to donate. Mm-hmm. Because we don't. If we approach it with more of a honeycomb mentality where it's a bunch of bees coming together, if we all do our part, then we can make a much bigger impact than you or I can make alone. And I was like, well, gosh, why can't we do this? I was like, I don't have a full-time job. I got time, so let's try. And next thing you know, here we are. So it's, you never know what's going to happen next, but it's what I try to encourage everyone, is that oftentimes the career path will unveil itself, and it'll be a beautiful thing if you don't do what I did, from a focusing on yourself, just focus on others and just serve.
Well, I can't thank you enough for sharing your story, sharing the honest, side of your story and the vulnerability and your learnings along the way. I think there are so many different pieces of advice that have flown through this that I think people have probably picked up. Is there any sort of final advice or final thoughts, moment of zen or anything before we wrap up?
Oh man. Yeah. I guess the biggest thing for me is that everything that I've learned, I've stolen. I mean, none of this is original. I'm not smart enough to figure this stuff out, period. But there are so many amazing people and resources. And for me, my faith is a big part of that. But, the book, The Servant by James Hunter, is probably the most transformative book I've ever read in my life. And it basically details this man, Len Hoffman, who was a CEO for Southeast Airlines back in the 80s and Fortune 500 CEO, who lost his wife due to a brain aneurysm and ended up going and becoming a monk. He disappeared off the face of the planet. And it's this story of this other guy, the author of the book, who goes and was in a similar position to me, where he thought he had everything figured out, was crushing his job. Everything seemed fine, but his wife wasn't happy. His kids didn't like him. It was just a tough situation. He goes on this retreat, not a spiritual retreat, but just a leadership retreat to this monastery and his journey through that book. I probably cried every chapter of reading that book, and I've read it probably once every 4 months ever since I read it for the first time, probably 3 years ago. And my advice is for people to get that book and to read it and to understand that we're in a new era of leadership and business. And it's an era now more than ever in the midst of the Black Lives Matter movement and the Me Too movement, that the more that we focus on serving others and existing to show sacrificial love, the more we're actually going to succeed in our own careers. And I think that now more than ever, our world needs a lot of love.
Yeah, it is so true. If we are not lifting others up, we are not going to make it in this world. Well, thank you again for the amazing advice, the inspiration, the humility, the honesty, the laughter. Like, you are a great storyteller. So thank you for sharing all of that.
Honor was mine, Karen. Thank you.
Thank you again to Mitch for sharing his story of how he found a fulfilling career by taking each roadblock, or his oh crap moments, as an opportunity to take a turn in a different direction. Check out our Facebook group, Career Changers, to keep the conversation going. And I hope today's conversation helped inspire you. And if it did, please consider subscribing to this podcast, sharing it with others, and leaving a rating and review on the platform of your choice. Until next time, remember, there's always a way to get off the hamster wheel.